The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. On our last program, we had begun to look at some of the difficulties of providing an answer to the question of what sponges evolved from. I had read the discussion in the current textbook that we use for our invertebrate zoo classes here at the university, and the authors had proposed three different possibilities for the origin of sponges. Now, I do not want to be unduly finicky nor unduly critical, but I do think it's important that we establish clearly that when there are three mutually exclusive ideas about how a group of organisms have come into existence, that this is rather clearly evidence of the fact that no one knows how they came into existence, and there are not any ancestral candidates that could be noted as possible. Now, there are rationalizations that can be made in order to try and find some kind of mythical ancestor, which is very different from knowing with reasonable certainty what those organisms were. Now, we have not yet discussed in any detail the structure of sponges, and as a matter of fact, there are some very different structural characteristics of sponges, which I think is probably one of the reasons for the third choice, that polyphyletic business, namely indicating that there were multiple origins for sponges. Now, there's lots of sponges, some 5,000 species, according to Hickman's book currently, and they're very different from one another, as we'll talk about when we start talking about some of the structures. But the notion that evolution is the answer as to how all of the varieties formed, or that evolution is the answer as far as where they have come from, is pure speculation and nothing more. I do not disagree with a person who chooses to, that speculation as the attempt at describing where they came from. But I do think it's important that it be indicated very plainly that it is just speculation, not more than that. It's not science of some kind, which is the conclusion that people try and leap to on occasion. Now, there is a page, I'm looking here at a page of discussion about this. It's not my intent to read that, probably take this whole program and some more to do that. But I want to read the section which is the author's discussion of the third possibility. The first possibility was that you had a multinucleate ciliated cell that was the origin of sponges. The second, colonial flagellates. This means that you have flagellated cells which have clumped themselves together into a colony. This was the source of sponges. And then finally, the polyphyletic origin is simply the notion there were three different. There was more than one source for the different sponges. Now, let me read the comments here about that third possibility. Some zoologists prefer the idea that the metazoans had a polyphyletic origin and suggest that the sponges, cnidarians, ctenophores, and remaining eumetazoans evolved independently. Thus, no single scheme might account for them all. We now have evidence based on small subunit ribosomal RNA sequences and on similarities in complex biochemical pathways. This evidence generally supports the colonial flagellate hypothesis, that is, that metazoans represented a monophyletic, a one evolution assemblage, all the organisms coming from one ancestor, including coanoflagellates, the collared flagellates, such as the Codostiga. And we'll talk about what coanocytes are a little bit later. Very unusual, very specialized cells, and the difficulty of having those evolve staggers my mind. But at any rate, we'll discuss that those cells as soon as we get to them. The sister group of metazoans appears to be the fungi. Now, boy, you want to stir up some difficulties, you try and have the fungi coming from the same ancestors that sponges have come from. And it is interesting to me that the author has chosen to put that comment there. So we see, again, this whole series of programs deals with gaps. The fact that you have organisms that are observable, have been around for long periods of time, but there is nothing that would connect them with any other kind of organism. And bearing in mind that the evolutionary sequence is supposed to be from simple to complex, presumably you would be looking for simpler organisms that are going to evolve into more complex ones, and choosing candidates for that kind of thing, you don't find any good candidates for it. That's the primary thing that I want to the listeners, who, particularly those who do not have much of a background in biology, to understand. Now, let's talk a little bit about the actual structure of sponges. If you were to go to a store and buy a bath sponge, for example, that brown spongy thing that you would pick up and perhaps use to wash your hide with or your car with, it's important to understand that that really is not the organism. The organisms would be cellular structures that are found coating the brown spongy material that's left. You dig them off of the bottom of the ocean, bring them out, dry them, wash them, etc. So you're really looking at the skeleton of the sponges, not the organisms themselves. And sometimes I think people perhaps may not be aware of that. Now, what has happened, if you're an evolutionist, is that you're looking here at a group of organisms who have not even multiple germ layers here, but they are multicellular organisms with a variety of different kinds of cells that are doing separate jobs. This is what is sometimes referred to in biology as a division of labor. And so somehow you had groups of single cells that have managed to associate themselves, and then once that has happened, they stop doing certain things that they were capable of doing before and begin to specialize and do only certain things in the sponge itself, with one exception, obviously, and the one exception are the choanocytes, the collar cells that were mentioned previously. Now, obvious difficulties. What would be the basis for prior unicellular organisms to associate themselves into a single organism? Now, if you understand what the evolutionary theory requires, in my opinion, this is really a major difficulty. The whole argument for organisms, cells included, is that they are successful in doing what they do. Now, what is it that's going to be sufficient to persuade them to change their life cycles in major ways, accommodate other cells to form a colonial group of some kind, and then within that group have individual cells that are going to stop doing things they've been doing and begin to specialize in certain functions within the organism itself? And I would like to think I know something about the theory of evolution, and there is nothing that occurs to me within the traditional teachings of evolution that would be a basis that would make any sense as to why cells would choose to do that in any way. Now, there are four classes of sponges, and they have some very distinct differences between them. The four that are currently listed are the class Hexactinellida, or hyalo spongii. These are the sponges that are referred to as glass sponges. Most of the deep, these sponges are nearly all deep sea forms. That is, you're not going to go scuba diving off the beach a few feet and find most any of these. They are going to have siliceous spicules. Spicules are little structures, angular sometimes. In some cases, there are six rayed spicules with six spokes or points radiating out. In the case of the Hexactinellida, the spicules here are six rayed, but they are siliceous. Now, siliceous means that they are composed of silica. If I had the opportunity of meeting with each of you and asking you to give me a specimen of silica, I'm not sure what your response would be. Some people, I think, well, I don't have any idea what that is. Window glass would be silica, silicon dioxide. Glass is an example of this. Now, again, I don't want to spend a lot of time majoring on something of no consequence, but I cannot refrain from observing at this point that a living organism's ability to form and deal with and dissolve silica is immensely interesting. I think back to the time I was in chemistry in high school. At that time, I don't think they do this anymore because of the EPA or somebody else, but back then we'd take a glass plate, coat it with wax, and get some sharp instrument and write some timeless message on the scratch through the wax down to the glass, and then pour hydrofluoric acid on it. That hydrofluoric acid would then etch the glass, so you'd have a glass with your message on it. Now, hydrofluoric acid is an immensely strong, active acid against living material, and yet somehow you have these live organisms that have the ability to metabolize that, to form it, to dissolve it. There are lots of other diatoms can do this. There are some of the rushes that can do this, but it still is a very interesting, unique ability. And I would be very interested to know how sponges are going to evolve the genetic and the enzymatic capability of simply performing that task when this is a characteristic that is found in all of the Hexactinellida, the high-low sponges, all of the glass sponges. I would argue simply it's not something that's going to evolve. It was something that is evidence of an intelligent creator.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson at bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.